This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to porn and Japanese trains. This week it's all about porn, whether it's being restricted on search engines or banned from Google Glass.
Plus, are you actually dead when a paramedic says you are? Two doctors have called for a review of how we classify what death actually is.
And we put on our mystic Meg mask and peer into the Wired crystal ball to ask, Wired crystal ball, what is Apple going to release at its conference next week?
It's a shiny ball. All that and more coming up.
Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook of your choice from a catalogue of over 80,000 titles. To claim yours now, go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up for your free trial and your free book.
I'm your host, Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Olivia_Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And this is the last week for 2 weeks I'm going to be here. I'm going to LA on Sunday for E3. I'm very excited.
2 weeks? I thought it was 1 week.
I won't be back here until 2 weeks' time.
Oh, okay.
Because next week we're gonna have something a bit different next week, actually. We should probably tell people. We're gonna have two podcasts.
Whoa.
We're gonna have the regular podcast, which Liv will be hosting, and then you're gonna have a special E3 dedicated Future of Gaming podcast, which I'm gonna be doing from LA, with a bunch of other people from the E3 games floor. It's very exciting.
Sucking all the best tidbits out.
Let's get on with the news, shall we? Liv, I want to talk about porn. Lots of porn in the news this week.
Yeah. There's been a bit of furore about pornography, and MPs and charities are now calling for search engines and ISPs to restrict access to pornography for everybody.
That's all porn.
All porn. Now, the reason this has happened is because a debate has been triggered after it was discovered that two murderers who killed children had been viewing indecent images of children before they went on to murder. So in the case of April Jones, this is a man called Mark Bridger. And the other case was 12-year-old Tia Sharp, who was killed by Stuart Hazel last year.
But specifically, these new laws are actually about all pornography, like not child pornography, obviously.
This is the extraordinary thing. They're looking at Culture Secretary Maria Miller is planning to meet with Google, Facebook and other web companies to discuss illegal content online. But a number of organisations have been calling to ban pornography altogether. Well, not ban, block it from the internet, so that you'd have to actually kind of opt in to view it. So they're saying that, you know, they need to take more responsibility. But the thing is, these sorts of images are already, you know, removed by service providers if they are reported. There's an organization called the Internet Watch Foundation set up to do just this. It lets anyone report any images via an anonymous hotline. But the problem is, not enough people know about this service, or they're too embarrassed when they come across this sort of material to actually make any official announcement that they've discovered it. Apparently, according to a study, 1.5 million British adults come across content depicting sexual abuse of children every year, which is huge in my opinion. But only 40,000 reports were made in 2012. John Carr, Secretary of Children's Charities Coalition on Internet Safety, wow, that's a mouthful. He seems to claim that there's a direct link between men looking at these images and men going on to abuse children.
Now, is he saying there's a direct link between viewing pornographic images, legal pornographic images?
He's saying child pornographic images.
Okay.
So I don't know where he got that from. I think there was a study that has shown there's a more of a propensity, but, you know, whether or not that's causation or correlation remains to be seen. But so what they're looking for to do is to get a search engine such as Google to set their default search the safest option, blocking both legal and illegal content. So anyone wanting to access pornography legally would have to enter some kind of login details or kind of unselect something. And the idea was this would act as a deterrent.
This is riddled with problems, isn't it? As a method.
There are so many things wrong with this. The first thing is it conflates child pornography with legal pornography. You know, it's kind of bundling them together as if somehow they're related, or that somehow if you're looking for pornography, it's very easy to stumble across child pornography. Secondly, Google already de-indexes any known child abuse material. So to kind of put this blame onto Google, they do not condone in any form child pornography, and they will remove it as soon as they are able to. But the third issue, I think, is it's the whole slippery slope issue. Should The Sun have to be blocked because of their page 3, where the girls have their, you know, their boobs out? Should they then restrict sports sports websites for fear of kind of provoking a gambling addiction, and it goes on and on and on. And then the final issue is, you know, there's not a huge amount of evidence to suggest that seeing child pornography causes you to be a paedophile. You are likely to already be predisposed, and this is just something that you do in the course of your paedophile ways.
Yeah.
I think with these cases that they highlighted, the kind of Mark Bridger and Stuart Hazel cases, it was highlighted in the case as they were doing this the day before and then this happened as contributory evidence. It wasn't like this is the first time they've ever looked at it. They didn't say anything about what they were looking at a year ago or 2 years ago or when they were, you know, 15 years old. It's just something that was part of the legal case.
So what do we think's the solution here? I mean, do you think that we need to change anything at all?
I think one thing is that the Internet Watch Foundation could be used more. They could have more funding, and they could be better resourced, and they could be better marketed, because most people probably don't know they exist. And if there was a bit more communication about how people could use it and, you know, not be implicated, they might be more encouraged to use their services. Beyond that, I don't think a blanket block on anything is ever the right answer. It drives people underground. You know, the sorts of people who are looking for these images are already operating under the radar, you know, using different VPNs and the kind of the dark web, as they call it. I just don't think making it more difficult for people to view pornography that's fully legal is a good thing.
Let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Very interested in your views on your ideal method for curbing this sort of thing would be. We're going to stay on the topic of pornography, though, but on a slightly lighter note. A change to the Google Glass terms and conditions have effectively banned adult content from the wearable electronic, if you like, and has forced the developer MyCandy to rethink one of its creations. Pardon the name here, but there's an app called Tits and Glass, which launched on the 3rd of June and generated quite a few thousand visitors to its website. But then Google updated its policy for Google Glass and what it calls glassware, so software for Google Glass, seemingly in response to this app coming out, although it was probably coincidence. And so the developers had to rethink its plans.
So hang on. What was this app actually going to do?
You could view porn on Google Glass. So the new T&Cs on Google Glass do now say, quote, "We don't allow glassware content that contains nudity, graphic sex acts, or sexually explicit material." And MyCandy CEO Jesse Adams came out and said that the clause only appeared on Google's website over the weekend after they'd started planning this. And he says, quote, "When we received our glass and started developing our app a couple of weeks ago, we went through the policy very carefully to make sure we were developing the app within Google's terms." And they probably were, and it does seem like the terms were changed kind of on the way.
Yeah.
Now, this is a real issue, I think, because number one, legal porn is legal.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is a problem with pornography being on any device if it's legal.
Yeah. And the person is the right age and they, you know. Yeah.
I think for Google, this is like they're trying to advertise Google glasses. You wear it every day for your everyday things. You're walking down the street, you're talking to someone, you're checking out maps. So if there's a guy walking down the street watching his porn.
Firstly, I don't think that is something that should matter to Google as a product necessarily. I think this comes down to PR.
And I think when they are trying to make
it look cool.
The nature of Google Glass is very, very controversial, depending on who you are. You know, a piece of technology that you're wearing over your face that's constantly pinging information in front of you and has a camera pointing at everything you can literally see, it's a controversial piece of kit. And I think that Google is trying to keep a track on all these sorts of things to make sure that the message going out onto, you know, your daily mails and your morning TV programs is not app for, you know, people walking down the street so, watching porn.
They don't really need it right now when everyone's saying, oh, they're not fashionable, oh, privacy concerns.
So that was the porn side of it. But then Google has also banned any apps on Glass that recognize people's faces. I've just noticed a typo in my notes here that actually says feces. I imagine that would probably also get banned. That's the best typo I've made all week. Anyway, Google posted a notice on Google Plus that said, "We've been listening closely to you and many have expressed both interest and concern around the possibilities of facial recognition in Glass. As Google has said for several years, we won't add facial recognition features to our products without having strong privacy protections in place. With that in mind, we won't be approving any facial recognition glassware at this time." I think, again, makes sense for Google that's trying to make sure that this product gets out with the right PR around it, and so people don't think it's some massively intrusive thing for porn addicts.
Yeah, once it's popular, bring on the porn.
You're already listening to the Wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
I want to talk about death, Liat.
Nate, again.
Once again.
So morbid. Yes. So a couple of doctors in the US attended the European Society for Anesthetology. I can never say that right. And have come out to say we need universal guidelines for diagnosing death. Now, you'd think, you know, it's pretty straightforward to diagnose death, but not so. There's been about 30 clinical cases recorded in recent history of something called Lazarus syndrome, where a patient comes back to life inexplicably. And for this reason, the doctors are saying we need to reappraise how we determine death, because there's no consensus across the globe. There's so many different, so many different procedures, and is everyone actually adhering to them? So in the UK, for instance, doctors are told to wait for a minimum of 5 minutes. This is kind of after resuscitation has ceased and they have flatlined and have no heartbeat. So where in Italy, doctors actually wait up to 20 minutes, and in the US, it can be under 5 minutes. There was one study actually done not long ago where into transplant retrieval, where institutes in the US were not waiting at all once the patients had flatlined. So they were just, you know, going straight in there. And the report said this totally ignores reports of spontaneous restoration that it says are underreported rather than being remarkably rare. Now, it's sort of known that brains can actually resume functioning after 10 minutes of no heartbeat. This is something that actually happened to a 66-year-old in 2002 who recovered on the table while a doctor was telling his students about the case. He diagnosed him, you know, as deceased 10 minutes prior, and his heart started beating again. For that reason, one of the doctors he wants to kind of go into all the different neurological tests for that we diagnose someone as deceased when they're on life support, because there's no consensus on that. Like, one country you have to have one doctor, one country you have to have three doctors, and there's different tests for reflexes and things like that.
What are they actually calling for to happen?
First of all, a universal minimum of 5 minutes where you sit and watch the body. You do not start chatting to your students, and you do go through all the tests and the neurological tests. And also more research into these neurological tests so that we're not taking people off life support unduly, so that there is no way that this can happen.
You've got a very interesting report, actually, on the website, Diagnosing Death. Will that search bring it up?
It will show up, yes.
One quick last story before we get into the second half of the show, Liv. We can't really not touch on the unrest going on at the moment in Turkey. A lot of attention being given to social media.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, very briefly, there's been some political unrest in Turkey. It initially started after there were some plans to build a shopping mall in a park in Istanbul. And police reacted to the protesters with quite a lot of violence and tear gas and rubber bullets. And this has then triggered a cascade of anti-governmental protests around the country. Now, the guy who's being the kind of target of many of these protests is the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And they argue that he's trying to impose conservative Islamic views on the already secular country. And so many people who are protesting, they're not particularly satisfied with the way that the media in Turkey is reporting these events. So they've been turning, of course, to social media, as we've seen over and over again. Now, Erdogan has come out and said that social media is, and I quote, the worst menace to society, saying that it's been used to spread lies about the protests.
Is that worse than Google Glass with porn on it, really?
Well, yeah. And is it worse than police kind of tear gassing kind of innocent people? But he seems to be pointing the finger at everyone else, saying that the protests are being whipped up by political opposition parties. Isn't that sort of what protests are anyway? And possibly foreign parties. He's been saying there's some mysterious foreign parties who might be involved in triggering all this unrest, as opposed to actual potential dissatisfaction.
Which is something that was said a lot, actually, during the Arab Spring.
Yes.
By leaders.
Exactly. But anyway, while that's been happening, interestingly, or perhaps expectedly, VPN use has absolutely shot up. Just one company, Ankufree, which is a California-based company, saw the number of installations of its Hotspot Shield VPN technology increase by 1,000%. They usually have about 9,800 installs per day. But on Saturday alone, it had almost 100,000 downloads. And this is because Turkey has quite a poor track record when it comes to filtering the web. In 2009, they actually blocked YouTube for 2 years, because 2007 rather, because it hosted a video that supposedly insulted Turkey's founder. Surprise, surprise, all of this has meant that Anonymous has got involved. You can't have a good protest without Anonymous getting involved. And so has the Syrian Electronic Army. And both are now laying claim to having hacked Turkish government websites.
Goodness me.
Yeah. So that was in a nutshell. We don't want to get too bogged down in you know, the political underpinnings of it. It's a fascinating story, but you should go and explore further.
Yes. Well, we're going to take a quick ad break. But when we come back, why does Singapore want your money within a week? Liv, I want to tell everyone about Audible. We recently teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer every single listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook when they sign up for a 1 month free trial of audible.co.uk. And I actually just downloaded David Attenborough's updated autobiography, because he's got a new series coming out, and I was quite interested in his background. But there are over 80,000 other titles available, and they work just like a podcast, so they'll play it on your iPhone, or basically whatever you're listening to this on probably plays an audiobook. So you can try out a free book, sign up for a 1 month trial at audible.co.uk/wired, download said book, and enjoy it on us while supporting our podcast. And there's no commitments. If you cancel after your free trial ends, that book is still yours to keep. Give it a go. That's audible.co.uk/wired. It's time to lay our segment egg, crack it open, and see which segments we've got swimming in our yolk this week. First, it's Oh No They Didn't. This week in Oh No They Didn't, Singapore.
So this is more digital rights news. Singapore's introduced a pretty extraordinary new piece of regulation. From this week on, any website with more than 50,000 monthly uniques, any Singaporean website, that writes about Singapore in pretty much any capacity must pay a license fee of 50,000 Singaporean dollars, or about £26,000.
Phew, that actually excludes you then.
That does, thankfully, exclude me. But this has been issued by the country's Media Development Authority. And it happened last week. They announced this new licensing regime and they implemented it the next day without any consultation. And the idea is it's supposed to bring websites in line with traditional media channels such as TV companies. So any TV company that has more than 50,000 viewers also has to abide by these rules.
Why?
Because it's about they don't want any content that is offensive to the state, basically.
Okay.
So they've got this is the kind of, I guess, the Ofcom equivalent, but a much more puritanical version of Ofcom. And there's lots of things that they ban, and some of them are very understandable and some of them are less so. So they have a large list of regulations, and they ban any material that advocates homosexuality or lesbianism.
What?
Or depicts and promotes incest, paedophilia, bestiality and necrophilia.
Okay, I'm a bit more on board with that second bit.
But yes, yeah, so suddenly there are a lot, there are quite a few gay community websites who have more than 50,000 viewers who are wondering, visitors who are now wondering, are they going to have to pay this quite hefty license fee or actually be banned altogether by the fact that they, by signing up to this license fee.
Do you think news sites, tourism sites,
well,
everyone?
Hasn't Yahoo News actually been?
They've only specified about 7 websites that have to at this stage pay for the license. But that's not to say, they're definitely not the only ones with more than 50,000 monthly uniques. And they mentioned Yahoo News and Channel News Asia and various other kind of very big media outlets online. It's quite scary that they had just a week before they had to pay up. I think it was 28th of May when it was announced, and then they had to pay up by the 5th of June. And then now the MDA is after them all.
But they haven't said, they're going to close down all these websites.
Said they're going to close down. It's more about I think it's the size and that they should be paying this license. And then by signing up to that license, they're contractually obliged to adhere to these regulations, which before was a bit more kind of a grey area.
Bad news bears.
Bad news for bears.
Yeah. Well, if you're a gay bear.
Yeah. Good news for probably actual bears, for the bestiality part of things.
Or a dead bear.
Why does it have to be a dead bear?
Because necrophilia.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be a bear.
Would it double the fee if you were having sex with a dead bear?
I don't know.
Awful.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
Second segment. Meanwhile in Japan. This is where we discuss what's happening in Japan. Meanwhile, I suppose. This is a massively fast train, Liat.
Super fast.
Zooming over the rails of life.
Tested for the first time this week, it can run at speeds of 500 kilometres per hour.
Good old Japan.
Just picture that, people.
Yeah.
To put this in context and to depress everybody, the high-speed 2 rail link in the UK that is not going to be launched until 2026 can only reach a paltry 306 kilometres per
hour.
What
a pathetic train.
I know. What's the point?
It deserves to be disrailed.
Decades of work. Well.
Not with people in it.
Yeah. So these tests have been taking place on an 18 kilometre stretch of track at Yamanashi, which will eventually form part of the maglev train's route. That will actually cut the bullet train's current 90 minute trip between Tokyo and Nagoya to just 40 minutes, which is a bit ridiculous. Mm. Now, how these trains work, they work on a system of powerful magnets that actually lift them off the track. So there's no friction, nothing to slow them down, no chance of dodgy weather making the tracks unsuitable for travel and things like that. So it's expected to actually begin travel in 2027, 1 year after our lame train launches.
That's awesome. That's awful. I'm going to be in Japan in September.
I know. Well, sorry. You're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait quite a while, a couple decades. Mm. And then it's going to expand onto Osaka by 2045, cutting that link from Osaka back to the capital for 1 hour, 7 minutes. It's ridiculous. Driving there takes like 3.5 hours or something, 4 hours, according to Google Maps. So,
hasn't China got one that's going to go at about 1,000 kilometres?
Well, these are, I mean, there have been reports, and basically, yes, there's going to be a little bit of competition. It's kind of
competition between the Chinese and the Japanese.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if reports are true, it's not even competition, it's just going to blow them out of the water, because they actually want to develop a maglev train that runs through a vacuum. That is proper science fiction futurism, I think.
This is the railway equivalent of willy waving, I think.
It's pretty cool, though.
But really
fast. I would wave it.
Yeah.
If I had such a fast willy, I would wave it.
You're listening to the wired.co.uk podcast. Got a comment? Drop us a line, or several lines, on podcast@wired.co.uk.
What's this? It's shiny and round. It's the Wired Crystal Ball. This week, we're peering into a new segment, specifically into the Wired Crystal Ball. This is our sphere of truth, where we look into things we expect to happen.
And rumours.
And rumours, yeah. Kind of the rumour mill, but another podcast uses the rumour mill. So we're
a sphere.
We're all about balls. WWDC is Apple's annual convention and developer conference. It's taking place next week. I'm not going to be here to cover it because I'll be in LA covering E3, and we'll come to that in a second. Liv is going to be covering it, and we thought we'd go down a few things that we're expecting, and then next week you can grade us on how well we did.
Yeah.
So, new Apple stuff. Firstly, new OS X. Pretty obvious. Expect that. 10.9. Kind of curious, though, because they're running out of names of big cats. We've had Leopard and Cheetah and Snow Leopard and Tiger and... there are a number of podcasts I listen to have speculated on things like OS X Grumpy Cat or OS X Maru. Don't think they're very likely. But I do wonder...
Lino, Chitara.
I think Liger. Liger could
Liger,
happen.
Yeah.
Liger could happen. But I do think that we're coming to the end of OS X as a brand name. And I wouldn't be surprised if this year they get rid of OS X as a name and it just becomes iOS for Mac or iOS for iPhone or something like that. Obviously very different operating systems underneath, purely from a naming convention. I do wonder whether we could see that. It would get around the problem that we're running out of cats to name operating systems
after. Well, they
could
go to an alternative animal, maybe a beaver.
Don't be silly. OS X Beaver.
Not very sexy.
Very cool. Okay, but also new iOS, that's pretty much a given. iOS 7, we're expecting a whole bunch of things in there. A flat interface, because Jony Ive, who is the lead designer for Apple's hardware, is now in charge of the software and the look and feel of iOS and OS X. And so we are expecting to sort of say goodbye to all the glass, the kind of 3D icons, all that
elements.
Sort of stuff. So no more notepads that try and look like little yellow notepads with pages torn off, or Game Center that's kind of a felt casino table.
Yeah.
So we're expecting to see that, although we're not expecting them to be released. So I don't think you're going to get new OS X next week. They're probably going to show them off and then release them later in the year. I do also think Retina MacBook Airs. This is an exciting one because Intel's just come out with these new Haswell chips that have significantly better graphics performance, but without increasing a load on batteries. And that's probably one of the things that was kind of holding back the previous generation of MacBook Airs. And that has got to come.
That will be a sexy
That is going to be. Imagine that thin little, you know, 11-inch MacBook Air with a Retina display.
Beautiful.
Sign me up. iRadio. This is an interesting one. Spotify iTunes.
Yeah.
iTunes Spotify.
Are they going to pull it off?
Eventually, but there's been a lot of debate as to whether Apple's got the deals in place with the major labels. So we think that they've got two out of three, but Sony's still outstanding.
I've had a conversation with someone today who seems pretty dead cert that it is going to happen.
Are they in the know?
Not in Apple. They were a competitor, but they are pretty dead cert.
The form we think this is going to take is free radio streaming. So this isn't like Spotify where you sort of search, I don't know, Napalm Death, double-click the song and it plays. This is sort of going to be playing the metal channel or the alternative channel or Justin Bieber channel, whatever. And it will be ad-supported.
So kind of Last FM style.
Kind of like Last FM, yeah, or Pandora, as opposed to anything else. And the last thing I wanted to mention, I really badly, badly want a Retina display iPad mini. I'm holding the iPad mini here.
Can I have that one then
right
when
now?
You get Retina display?
Yeah. Yeah, you can. You can have this if they bring a new one out. But we're going to be curious, Liv, if there's one thing that you're expecting to see, what do you think? What would you love? What do you want?
I would love a Retina MacBook Air.
Yeah.
To be fair. I mean, I'm okay with the Mini being non-Retina. I mean, it would be better if it was Retina, but I think it looks nice. I think it's, you know, the sort of things I'm using it for don't necessarily require Retina display. But that's what I say before I've seen it.
Well, we will find out next week. You can look forward to hearing all about that on next week's show. We will be covering the conference, of course. It takes place in the evening of Monday, the 10th of June. So look out for our coverage on Wired.co.uk for that. The other thing, E3, that's why I'm not going to be covering the Apple show this year, because I'll be over in the middle of an Xbox One keynote. Rather than run down sort of what we're hoping to see, it's going to be the first time that we see the new PlayStation 4, because we've seen the controller, but we haven't seen the hardware.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be getting hands-on with all the new games, actually playing them.
So what are you most excited about then out there?
Well,
what are you allowed to say?
Well, there's some stuff I'm not allowed to say. That I'm massively excited about. There's a new, I think I can probably get away with this if we publish tomorrow afternoon. There is a game called The Fall, Deus Ex The Fall, which is the iPad, an iPad Deus Ex game, and it's a full game, and I've played it, and it's amazing. Yeah. It's like playing Human Revolution.
I mean, you came back from playing it, and I mean, that was the most excited I've seen you in a long time.
I was wearing my excitement pants. And only my excitement, fans. It's that's amazing. But in terms of what I'm excited to see from E3 itself, I got an invite today for a Future of Final Fantasy conference.
Oh, wow.
And I already know what they're going to be showing off Final Fantasy-wise, because I've also played those ahead of time, and we're not allowed to talk about those yet. And the fact that they're showing off the future of Final Fantasy, despite the fact that everyone who will be in that conference has probably also already had an embargoed hands-on with the new Final Fantasy. It means it's something else. I would love to think that they would do a remake of Final Fantasy VII for the PS4. I mean, it will sell like hotcakes and everyone wants it.
Yeah.
But also, there's a lot of discussion about a Final Fantasy game called Versus 13 that's supposedly been in development for years and years and years and kept getting pushed back. And it's sort of part of the Final Fantasy 13 series. It was supposed to take place within the same universe. It would be a much darker Final Fantasy game. And it never came out. And rumor has it, it's been bumped over for next gen. And that's something that we'll actually see at the show, which could be very exciting.
And of PS4 versus Xbox One, which are you more excited about?
This is the thing. Like, they're the least exciting consoles in a way, because they're as close to each other as they've ever been. They literally have the same specs.
Yeah.
And also, they're basically now just PCs in a box, in a sort of, I don't know, set-top box.
Yeah.
You know, they use PC-type hardware. They use the same architecture as a gaming PC. So there's never been little less to differentiate the two, in a sense.
Yeah.
I'm technically more excited about the PS4 simply because it has a slightly greater focus on gaming.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Japanese games, and Sony's PlayStation is Japanese. And so I'm expecting there'll be a slightly greater emphasis on Japanese titles for the PS4 than perhaps the Xbox. But I'll have both of them. I'll play both of them, and they'll both be brilliant. So we got one quick little bit of feedback before we end the show. And we had a comment come in from Thomas on our Mammoth hit with pickaxe spurted blood story. And he said, "I wonder what Mammoth steak tastes like." And I wanted to point this out because I think this is a problem we have as humans. if we think either discover a new animal or think about bringing another animal back or whatever, and the first thing is, ooh, wonder what it tastes like. Let's eat it.
He has got me thinking now, though. Best steak you've ever had.
The best steak I've ever had, I can tell you, it was at the tram shed in London. They should pay for the endorsement I'm about to give. That is the best steak, specifically that steak. The one I've eaten.
It looks incredible.
I haven't been to Hawksmoor.
Hawksmoor's got to be the best.
That is delicious pants. Yeah. I mean, that is excitement pant beef.
Well, you can write in, of course, podcast@wired.co.uk. I think that's all we've got for this week.
I think that is.
Remember, we've got an episode next week from E3 and your regular episode, a double feed week. We'll see you then.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.